You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jasa mong toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā, te rā rua te kaumarima o Pipiri. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for today, Thursday the 25th of June. My name is Justin, and if you're wondering where's Mary Margaret, I swapped with her this week, so don't be alarmed. But joining me today is Ollie Joblin, who is making his Wire studio debut, am I right?
You are, yes.
Yes, how does it feel, first week in the studio?
It's nice. I had a wee story on The Wire during lockdown, but it was from my lounge, so this is nice to be in the studio.
Much more professional.
A little bit, yeah.
Yes. And speaking of professionalism, coming on the show today, I first spoke to Justice Minister Andrew Little about the third reading of the Prisoner Voting Bill, COVID-19 quarantine and testing, rape trial processes and cybersecurity. Ollie then talked to Jeff Key from Forest and Bird about the government's updated threat management plan to protect hectares and Maui dolphins. And finally, Zoe Canandes from Radio Adelaide joined us on Neighbourhood Watch to talk about state border restrictions, community TV closures and changes to university course fees. As always, ko e ware ware. E ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano he pakihere roki marunga i te paitu tukutuku o irirangi poho me haru haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, but if you want to get in touch with us, you can text us on 5395 or waimairane, call us on 309-3879. Now, it is time for...
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week I spoke to Justice Minister Andrew Little about quarantine and testing, cybersecurity and the proposed sexual violence legislation bill. But first, we talked about the prisoner voting bill, which passed its third reading in Parliament last night amidst a bizarre twist with National supporting a Green Party amendment. And it was an interesting night last night, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little frustrating, annoying, but I think it is the worst of kind of game playing that we saw with the National Party. I'm not sure the Green Party quite realised what they were doing. They put up a symbolic amendment that they didn't expect to be getting voted up. The National Party voted up by taking everybody by surprise. But it is, you know, it's kind of mucking around with our electoral law. So that was disappointing, but it is what it is, and we'll fix it up next week.
Exactly. What does this mean now when the Second Amendment by the Greens got voted in by the National Party?
The Second Amendment, all it did was take an administrative power that the Electoral Commission currently has to remove names from the roll of people who are disqualified and abolishes that power to remove those names. That's all it does. It doesn't change the substance of the bill, which is to restore the right of prisoners who are sentenced to a term of less than 3 years to vote. So that remains intact and they'll be able to exercise those rights. And even though those who are otherwise disqualified from voting won't have their names removed from the roll as they would currently, it doesn't mean they get the right to vote or retain the right to vote. It is purely, all that happened was the National Party supported an administrative measure that is of little or no significance whatsoever. I think their public statements are overblowing what they've done, but it is an inconvenience. We'll get it fixed next week, but it is not significant.
How are you going to fix it next week? What's the legislative procedure for that?
You just introduce a bill to amend it and to reinstate the power that was removed last night. We'll just reinstate it next week. Because the third reading passed, we now have to wait till the bill gets its royal assent. It goes to the Governor-General. That'll happen in the next few days. Once that happens, then we can introduce a bill next week to correct what shouldn't have happened last night. And even though the amendment that was put up last night came from the Green Party, they will support the change back because that amendment went hand in hand with the other one that they put up that they also didn't expect to get passed and it didn't get passed. So it's all a little confusing. I know it is kind of politics. I think at this stage of the electoral cycle, when we're 3 months out from the general election, Now, smaller parties are there to distinguish themselves from the bigger parties. They do that through signalling various things, usually amendments to legislation. Nobody expected any of the amendments yesterday to pass. The National Party mysteriously and out of the blue supported one of them. They did it to kind of, you know, muck things up. They think that it's okay to play those sorts of games, particularly with our electoral laws. I think it reflects poorly on them. Anyway, they did what they did. We're in the situation that we're in, and next week we will correct it.
And I kind of want to move to our next topic, which is quarantine. It's gained a lot of attention before the past week, especially now more airlines are now opening their routes back to New Zealand, and that could mean much more pressures being put on our quarantine facilities. Now, we have seen in the past couple of days that some travellers arriving at Auckland have to be diverted to Rotorua or Hamilton, and now there are plans to have to move those in quarantine to Christchurch as well. Could our quarantine facilities cope when we gradually open our, not gradually open our borders, but allowing more people to come back in?
Yeah, I think, let's be, just to be absolutely clear, the people who are coming back in are New Zealand residents and citizens, so they're people who have a right to come back here, and we can't stop them if they wish to come back. And we now have, I think we've doubled the number of people crossing the border each day compared to even sort of 2 or 3 weeks ago. So there has been a significant increase. Some of them are repatriation flights that have been negotiated over a period of time between our government and other governments and various airlines. So a lot of the folks coming back in from India, for example, via Air India flights, that's been negotiated for some time. So look, we're trying to now manage that flow. We do have, look, we can accommodate about 4,500 people in our quarantine facilities. And bearing in mind that, you know, every day there's people who come in, but equally there's every day there's people who have completed their 14-day quarantine period, who are being tested and who are being released. But the volume of those coming across the border is such now, we do need to more carefully manage that. Look, we're confident we do have the facilities to do it. We've got to make sure those facilities are managed well and properly, and that that's not posing any further risk. We always predicted that as more people came across the border, and as they were going into a quarantine, that we would pick up more people diagnosed with COVID-19, and that is happening. But everybody who is being diagnosed with it, every new case, is being picked up through the quarantining process, which is the right thing to do, and is not putting, you know, the community at risk. The main thing is to avoid community transmission, and at the moment we are doing that, and you know, we're pretty confident that we will keep community transmission at bay.
Speaking of community transmission, now, because more people are voluntary testing for COVID-19, which is a good thing, but some, as Stuff reported yesterday, some of the traffic jams for testing, someone needs to wait up to 2 hours just to get a test. Do you think we should have more testing points instead of putting them in specific places like malls, maybe even allow GPs to do the testing themselves?
Yeah, look, I think what happened, we were doing a lot of testing, you know, like 3 or 4 weeks ago, as the number of active cases fell, and the number of, in fact, we had 2 weeks or more of zero cases, then a lot of the community testing facilities were sort of wound up and packed up. Now we're in the process of putting some of those back, and also allowing GPs, obviously, to get to do testing as well. So that is starting to ramp back up again, I think, and partly because as we get deeper into winter, the colds and flus are starting to come back, and people want to be sure that it is just a cold or a flu, that it's not COVID-19. So you will see more testing facilities in what they call the community-based assessment centres. Some of them that were in operation a month or so ago will be reinstated so that we can get through a bigger volume of testing.
Moving on to an issue that happened over in Australia last week. Now Canberra has said there has been a major cyber attack on Australian businesses and different levels of government. Considering we have an election in mind, what is the current risk of New Zealand having a cyber attack?
Well, there's always a risk. I mean, we have cyber attacks are happening all the time. We have a low incidence of cyber attacks in New Zealand, and that could be anything from, you know, attacking network to bring it down, to, you know, phishing scams, to ransomware attacks, and we've had some of those have hit the headlines just in recent weeks. So we are, you know, we're as susceptible as anybody to it. I think what Australia was pointing out is that there had been a major escalation in the incidence of those cyber attacks for them. We haven't seen that here, but as I say, it remains a risk. In terms of the election, the Electoral Commission is working, you know, closely with their experts and indeed our security and intelligence agencies to make sure that their database of registered voters is protected, and that their systems, their online systems, are protected as well. So I'm confident that we are doing everything we can to protect our networks, to protect our data, and so that our election and the integrity of it is protected as well.
And moving on to the sexual offences bill that you have put in Parliament. Now, there are a couple of issues raised by New Zealand First and some defence lawyers over the issue of fair trials. And in fact, New Zealand First Minister Tracy Martin told our colleague Lillian Hanley yesterday that there are systematic failures, such as police pushing cases without sufficient evidence, that led to a low number of rape prosecutions, of successful rape prosecutions and allegations going to court. And what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I hadn't heard you know, issues about lack of evidence by the police. What I know from surveys and what have you is that a lot of victims of sexual violence don't even report to the police because they find even having to do that too traumatic. Many are frightened off doing so because of the experiences of others who have gone through the court system. We know that those charges that do go to court, it's, you know, one of the lowest conviction rates of any class of offending is sexual violence offending. We know from the experiences of a lot of those who do give evidence that it is traumatic. This was looked at by the Law Commission, and they formulated a bunch of recommendations, which is the basis of the sexual violence legislation bill, to try to remove the more traumatic aspects of the court process for victims of sexual violence. The complaints by the lawyers are, first of all, that doing pre-trial cross-examination, so the victim gets to give their evidence on video and be cross-examined on video, means that they might have to show their hand or disclose their defence early. That doesn't need to be the case. If that video evidence is done a week or so before the regular trial, they don't lose anything as a result. Their second objection is that there would be limits on cross-examining on the sexual history between the victim and the defendant. Now, the role of the Crown is to prove that the particular incident that constitutes the sexual violence happened, that it wasn't consensual. Consent given on previous occasions doesn't mean that consent is given for subsequent occasions. Actually, the defence loses nothing by applying that principle. They're claiming that it does. I certainly disagree with that. But look, New Zealand First is taking time to examine it more closely. I know that they're talking to others and talking to Crown prosecutors and others. So it's fine for them to do that. So we'll see where we get on that.
Do you think the bill itself offered the balance between the victim and the right to be proven guilty? Because certainly those defence lawyers and New Zealand First think it it floats too heavily on the victim for these proposals.
Yeah, look, just on one point there. Look, in fairness to New Zealand First, they haven't taken a position on whether they agree with the defence lawyers and the comments they're making. They've heard what they've said and said, okay, well, we want to have a look into this. And I think, to be fair to New Zealand First, an issue has been raised with them. They haven't formed a view on it. They want to get more information on it. In terms of the defence lawyers and what they're saying, I think they are being alarmist. And look, there's a bit of patch protection going on here. They want to preserve the situation that they've got. But the reality is, far too many victims of sexual violence going through the process, from complaining to the police to being prepared for trial and going to trial, are being traumatised as a result. And that is not right. There is another problem with the law that we have, and that is that the lower level sexual offending ends up, results in quite serious charges being laid, with very serious penalties, starting at 14 years prison for that. And so it forces defendants, regardless of the level of offending, to put on the maximum kind of defence. Whereas there is a level of sexual offending where even victims are saying, look, I don't want the guy to go to prison. I just want him to acknowledge what he's done to me and the harm he's caused, and I want to find a different way through this. The criminal justice system doesn't allow that and accommodate that, and we do have to find a way to allow that to happen, and that'll be the next tranche of work that we do. But in the meantime, those who are facing, defendants who are facing trial, shouldn't be allowed then to further traumatise the victim, and we're just trying to find the balance that allows fair trial rights to be respected and observed, but victims not to be further traumatised.
But are you confident that you can bring New Zealand First on board and get this bill passed before the election?
Look, I can't guarantee it's going to be passed before the election. I think New Zealand First are doing the responsible thing. They've had issues raised with them that's caused them to be concerned. They're going out and getting additional information and talking to other people, independent of those who have talked to them so far. I think that is the right thing to do. But how long that takes them and where we get to is difficult to tell. So I can't say whether or not it'll be passed before the election.
And my final question for today is, you now have three bills being stored by New Zealand First, including the rape trials legislation, the hate speech legislation and rent relief legislation. And with Labour's main flagship policies from this capital gains tax to as recent as yesterday, the Auckland Light Rail being stalled because of difference with its collision partners as well. Are you willing to work with New Zealand First again after the election if you have to form a government with them?
If the circumstances were such that we were in a position to form a government, obviously we'd look very closely at New Zealand First. We'd have to. Apart from the last few weeks, we've actually worked very well and very closely with New Zealand First. The reality is we are in the sort of twilight zone before the next general election. Parties like New Zealand First and, if that matter, the Greens, are busily trying to clearly distinguish and delineate themselves from us and any other party in Parliament, and this is what this looks like. That's why the Green Party put up their amendment proposal on the prisoner voting bill last night. They wanted to be clear that this is what we stand for. They didn't expect it to pass, and then the National Party voted for part of it. And so these things happen, and likewise New Zealand First wants to be very clear about what they stand for, which they see they can do by, stopping various other proposals in their tracks. That's their judgment. We're 3 months out from the election. We expect it would get a bit like this. But actually, when you look back in the last 2.5 years, these are three parties that have formed a very stable and very good government.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi poho. That was our weekly chat with Justice Minister Andrew Little, and we have got a text about my chat with him about cybersecurity. There's a much bigger issue behind the cyber attacks hitting Australia. Australia has not stopped being bullied and targeted since proposing an investigation into the origins of the coronavirus spread. Is this what is going to happen to us if we seek more transparency on issues that affect us? Well, if you want to let me know more of your thoughts on my chat with Andrew Little, which we talked about prisoner voting rights, cybersecurity, COVID-19 quarantine and testing, as well as on rape, sexual offence legislation. You can do so by texting me on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. You're listening to 95BFM and we will go for a break. It's 12:24.
Being in the dark about your KiwiSaver is no big deal, right? It's just money. A few dollars. A few hundred thousand dollars. Who needs to retire? On the other hand, you could talk to Koura Wealth. Their 100% Kiwi-owned and operated KiwiSaver scheme is personalised for you, so you get the retirement you deserve. Ethical investments and some of the lowest fees in the industry. Shine a light on your future with Koura Wealth. Visit kourawealth.co.nz today. That's K-O-U-R-A wealth.co.nz.
Discover the diversity of science at the Royal Photographic Society Science Photographer of the Year exhibition, on now at MOTAT. For the first time outside of London, 47 intriguing images of science in action. Entry included with general admission. Go to motat.nz.
Listen. Listen to Sigrid's radio show. It's just music, but for 3 hours. Sigrid. Selections by Sigrid. Very good songs. Sigrid. It's Thursday afternoon, 1 to 4. Listen to it. The Thursday 1 to 4 with Sigrid on 95BFM. Listen live or tune in later on podcast and RSS. It's Thursday afternoon, 1 to 4. Listen, it's just music. It's just music.
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire. Welcome back to The Wire, and you're listening to 95BFM. And now, what's up, Ollie?
Well, yesterday the government announced an updated threat management plan to protect both hectares and Maui dolphins. There's 15,000 hectares and only around 60 Maui dolphins left in New Zealand waters, so extensive new protections are needed to be put in place to guarantee the survival of both species. The threat management plan looks to increase fishing restrictions in dolphin habitats, as well as non-fishing activities such as prohibiting new seismic surveying and seabed mining, expanding marine mammal protection areas, and rolling out an action plan to tackle toxoplasmosis. I spoke with Jeff Key from Forest and Bird on what he thinks of the new plan. The government has released the new updated threat management plan to look after the hectares and Maui dolphins to protect the species. Have you seen any loopholes in this plan?
Yeah, so when it came out, we were a little bit puzzled how to describe it, because there's some really, firstly, there is some really good stuff there. The protection from set netting for dolphins has increased quite a lot, and there are some sort of quite innovative things they want to try as well. But the problem is that there were loopholes, as you've alluded to. So one of the really big ones, for example, is oil and gas. So on oil and gas exploration in Maui habitat, when they go out there, they use seismic testing sounds. They basically let off big bangs underwater and use that to get a sense of what's happening under the seafloor. And that can be quite disturbing for marine mammals. So we wanted to see that banned, and it will be, but not until about 2046. And that's because the existing permit holders are exempt, and they've got permits to 2046. So, we will see a ban on seismic testing, but not for 25 years. So there are these kind of loopholes there, which mean it won't be as effective as we would have liked.
Would you like to see a change to those permits, or do you think that there could be a change to those permits, or are those locked in?
It's politics, right? I think, as I understand it, New Zealand First wants to protect the existing permit holders. So we saw that with the ban on oil and gas exploration more widely, that the existing permit holders are protected. The permits should just end. This is oil and gas exploration. We should just use what we have at the moment and then get out of it, not just for dolphins, but also for climate. But there's another problem in that as well, in that on the west coast of the North Island, the fishes will be able to continue trawling, but if they catch a dolphin, then the government will make a decision then whether or not to close the fishery. So there's about 63 dolphins left. We can't afford to lose a single one. And if the minister is sitting there with, news that the fishing industry caught a dolphin on the one hand, and the industry pushing really hard to not close the fishery on the other, then, what's the minister going to do? There's no guarantee that the dolphins will be protected at that time. And the fact that they're not willing to require trawling to change to long lining, which doesn't catch dolphins, is an indication that maybe they won't even decide to protect the dolphins even then, you know, if they catch. So, you know, we find that that's a bit of a worry in terms of what might happen in future.
Is there anything else you'd like to see added to the plan that would help protect the Maui and Hector's dolphins moving forward?
So the really big thing is to keep extending the protected areas so that fishers who want to go fishing in areas where there's either Maui's dolphin or Hector's dolphin have to use methods of catching fish that don't harm the dolphins. Like, literally nobody in the country is saying to fishers, stop fishing. What they're saying is, use methods that don't kill dolphins. So, you know, so instead of set netting or trawling, they could look at long lining or potting, so where you drop pots down and catch the fish in those. You know, there are other methods they can use that don't catch dolphins.
What's sort of the reaction that you've seen, or have you seen any reactions from the fishing industry in regards to the government's plan?
Well, the government's clearly, the industry is clearly a bit anxious about it, but, you know, the government is putting in money to support them. So one of the things that Forest and Bird, and say other NGOs as well, argued was that there should be a package to help fishers transition. So some fishers, for example, who currently go set netting in areas that they won't be allowed to anymore, will want to change what they do, you know, so they want to change to a different way of fishing, and what we've said is, well, the government should help them do that, and others may just simply decide that it's time to retire, and the government should help them to do that. So, so they are going to get a significant sort of package aimed at very practical help to either enable them to change the way they fish, or if they decide they've had enough, to leave fishing. So, you know, and I think that's probably softened some of the criticism, is the fact, you know, they are going to be supported through this.
In terms of breeding and growing the numbers of both species, are we leaving it to the dolphins and their natural breeding habits, or is there human intervening? Are we interacting at all to help them, or is it leaving it completely up to the dolphins?
There's no dolphin love hotels out there. They are, they're definitely, we're leaving it to the dolphins. I mean, the main thing, really what they need is for to not be killed by us. That's it. They can look after themselves, provided we stop killing them. So, you know, and that's the whole, you know, purpose to the threat management plan. One of the issues is, if you take Hector's dolphin, which is all around the South Island, I mean, there is plenty more of them compared to Maui's dolphin. You know, Maui's dolphin is, what, 63, roughly? No one's entirely sure. And there's about 15,000 of the Hector's dolphin. But the Hector's dolphin populations are all scattered around the South Island. So it's like having lots of Maori's dolphin populations, if you get my drift. And one of the worries is that we could lose those isolated populations one by one. So is we going to be really important that we protect their habitat right from the bottom of the South Island to the top of the South Island?
With the Maui dolphin, are they looking at expanding their habitat? Because are they just around Port Waikato and the Manukau Harbour? Is that correct?
Oh, they're up and down a fair bit of the west coast of the North Island. No one is entirely sure the absolute sort of northern and southern limit. Yeah, so because there are so few dolphins, it's extremely rare to actually see one. And certainly in the southern part of their habitat, sort of, you know, sort of Taranaki way, they've certainly sonar or underground undersea recording has picked up the calls of dolphins in the areas where they weren't known to be. So, you know, they're really, really hard to spot. And so, it's, you know, we know a fair bit of the west coast of the North Island, but no one really knows exactly where their habitat stops.
In terms of the numbers, because, you know, you mentioned around only 63 Maui dolphins, sorry, how quickly have we been seeing the numbers declining over the years?
I don't know the full sort of population over time, but they certainly disappeared relatively quickly a few decades ago, and then it's like there's been, for some years now, a small population just kind of clinging on.
The government also talked about the action plan for tackling toxoplasmosis, which I believe, is that spread by cat faeces?
Yeah, it's like, so this will be something that's probably quite a surprise to most people. It was certainly a surprise to me the first time I heard about it a few years back. So toxoplasmosis is a disease that gets carried by cats. And it gets spread through their feces. It's actually an issue for people as well, because people can get infected by toxoplasmosis. But what happens is that it spreads from the cat feces into water, and from water into fresh water into the sea, and then the dolphins get infected. And there's enough of that happening that dolphins are getting infected in the ocean, which is kind of mind-boggling. But that is what's happening. So, it's making them sick. It's killing some of them. There's a bit of argument as to quite how many, but it is a big problem. And so, yeah, the government has an action plan which we support to deal with that. But one of the things that's really crucial in this is that some people in the fishing industry are saying, well, why bother tackling fishing when you've got this other big problem out there? And it's like when someone ends up going to the hospital and in an emergency, you have to deal with those things that you can fix immediately, and then you work on those things that are going to take a bit longer. And if there's some really big problems that are going to take a bit longer, then you really have to fix things that need to be fixed immediately. So we know we can fix the problems with fishing straight away. We know we can prevent oil and gas exploration from harming dolphins. So we can do that straight away, and we should. And the fact that there's this other big problem means that tackling things like fishing and oil and gas exploration becomes far more important and far more urgent.
Is there anything that the public can do to help?
Yes. So this is kind of like, I guess, round two. Round three is coming up soon. So the government has announced the threat management plan. There is a bunch of regulations that legally they're able to do straight away, and they're doing that. And they will kick in 1st of October, and they relate to fishing. There are some regulations that they need to consult again before they finalise. So, and this is what I remember, like round two. So as round one was like getting the ideas together, round two was putting a proposed threat management plan out for public consultation. Round three is getting the actual consultation done on the sort of the final measures. That's a really good chance for people to go back to government and say, look, okay, so you're partway there, but you haven't finished the job. And to tell them to finish the job. So there will be information on the Department of Conservation's website, and I think also the Ministry of Primary Industries website as well. So people should just go to those, to Department of Conservation website or MPI, and then Google will pick it up pretty quickly, and sort of, yeah, just tell the government to finish the job.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
That was Jeff Key there from Forest and Bird talking on the updated threat management plan for Hector's and Maui dolphins.
Thanks very much, Ollie. You're listening to 95BFM. You're on The Wire with me, Justin Wong. We will be back after a quick song. This is Loop the Cube by Ripship.
To make it on the list, to be the Rubik's master, I need to spin it faster. There's one thing we can do.
Loop the cube!
I feel the friction burn. I need a faster turn. A sharp increase in speed is what we really need. There's one thing we can do.
Loop the cube! call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Welcome back to The Wire, and finally for this week in Neighbourhood Watch, Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis joined us this week, and we talked about the various states' border restrictions, community TV closures in Melbourne and Adelaide, and changes to university course fees. First up, there has been positive cases of coronavirus in the state of Victoria.
We have seen a little bit of a spike within Victoria of COVID-19. So that's the state that Melbourne is in. Don't think I had to explain that. Sorry. And there's obviously been a bit of contention around that because I feel like a lot of states here in South Australia, for example, we haven't had any cases for quite a while. And we're sort of, some states are really hoping to be able to reopen borders from state to state, so that people could go and see family members around the country. And this little spike in Victoria has somewhat put a spanner in the works. The New South Wales Premier has urged no one from New South Wales to visit anyone from Victoria, despite New South Wales and Victoria's borders both being open to each other still. So it's getting a little bit heated in terms of state borders being opened here. But in general, it is just a bit of a sad setback. This spike in Victoria, we're even seeing reports from Victoria that toilet paper is selling out again at the supermarkets, nothing on the shelf. So old habits are dying hard. It's just a shame that there's been this outbreak in Victoria, because it is having a ripple effect amongst the country in little ways.
And I see Mark McGowan, the Premier of Western Australia, has said he won't reopen borders with the rest of the Commonwealth. Is that the same for what is happening in South Australia right now?
Oh, it's so complex. Every state is a little bit different. I think South Australia is really keen to go back into Western Australia and the Northern Territory, where Western Australia is sort of, having nothing to do with any other state. Victoria wants to hang out with New South Wales, but New South Wales is like, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Queensland is kind of like open to anyone except for, I think, New South Wales and Victoria. And the Northern Territory have been open and back to normal for way before anyone else. So I'm not really sure what their plans are. But every state is quite different in what they want to achieve with state borders opening. And that's because it is entirely up to the state governments. And I don't think the federal government would really step in or intervene with that. Everyone's different. I think, it's so complex. It's hard to have a straight answer about that.
Moving on to uni fees, because for some reason, some Australia universities have decided to raise course fees of humanities courses while dropping the fees for some other ones. Can you talk us a little bit more about that?
Certainly. It is really disheartening. This was announced last Friday, just after Scott Morrison did a press conference about something else entirely, and half an hour he introduced this. So tertiary education overhaul, I guess, of humanities and communications. They'll be in the same cost bracket now as some law degrees. Fees increases will be implemented for courses that students are already undertaking as well. And the whole idea behind it is to kind of put people into more jobs you know, university degrees that actually get you jobs. I'm doing quotation marks. You can't see that. So, like, degrees that give you jobs. And it's a real shame. So things like a media course, for example, journalism would be the same as a law degree. It's a pretty huge increase. So humanities and social services degrees will increase by 113%. The government will increase its contributions to the cost of the classes they're trying to sort of remove. So students can expect to pay between $3,700 to $7,700, while course fees will more than double, putting them alongside things like law, as I mentioned, and commerce, which are in the highest price band of like $14,000 a year.
That's really terrible.
Yeah, it's hard to comprehend. At the start of COVID, we had an announcement from the federal government saying that they would be slashing some university degrees, the cost of them, because everyone had a bit more free time. And now we're seeing this. It's a real punch in the face for humanities and for the arts and for anything that isn't, you know, STEM. Not to say, obviously, that STEM is bad. We love STEM, but, like...
Yeah, it's hard to comprehend what Canberra is thinking when they are formulating this. But moving on, when we are talking about humanities courses being cut out, media and journalism being part of that, and now it's a double blow for community TV as well.
Yeah, this one hits really hard. Because being from a community radio background, community television in Australia, we have two stations left. We have Channel 31 in Melbourne and Channel 44 here in Adelaide. And essentially they have about 5 days left of before they're set to close. So real shame. Australia's last surviving community television channels and... they will be turned off and replaced with just white noise. It's a huge blow to Australia's sort of already bleeding media landscape. As I mentioned I feel like I mention it every week. You know, we had the ABC cuts. We had more ABC cuts yesterday, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Cuts across the whole entire media world here in Australia, and then just to see community television being cut as well, such salt in the wound. So the television sector, the community television sector here doesn't really receive government funding, whereas places like ABC and SBS do. And we've seen some of our biggest Australian movie personalities come from community television. And they only have 5 days to go. There's lots of petitions, sort of crowdfunding things. If anyone is interested in helping out, I know you're across the ditch, but if you do believe in community media, you can, you know, look that up for yourself and maybe sign something for us. But it's a pretty dire situation at the moment. And yeah, 5 days, June 30 is when they are planning to close. So I don't know if next week I'm going to be having this conversation and something's good happened for either Channel 31 or Channel 44, but I'll keep you all updated.
That was Neighbourhood Watch Ripper.
That was indeed Zoe Canandis from Radio Adelaide on Neighbourhood Watch, which we talked about our state's border restrictions in Australia, community TV closures, and changes to university course fees. You are listening to 95 BFM. It's just past 10 minutes to 1. We will be back after a minute.
Can you imagine the world before coffee?
I'll tell you what, I'm 2 coffees deep right now, and I'm still having trouble imagining the world. There's just so many bits in it. You know, it's just hard to keep it all in your head.
Maybe you have another coffee and try again.
Imagine Auckland before coffee. Thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters, you don't have to. Auckland's original coffee roasters and your local since 1992. Swing by their Kingsland-based cafe and roastery or shop online at atomiccoffee.co.nz.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century. 95BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
It's Totally Wired with me, Danielle.
Two to the left.
On Land of the Woodwood. Got lined up three songs.
For stopping by for the 95BFM Kids Show.
Greetings and welcome. This is the Rhythm Selection.
Never miss out again. Becast, available on Apple Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
That was The Wire.
Ko rā te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero me ki o mō tēnei rā. And that is all for the Thursday Wire for today, the 25th of June. Thank you to my producer, Ollie Joblin. How does it feel to be on the first week on the job, first day on the job?
It was good. Hopefully it wasn't my last one.
It certainly won't be the last one. You did great. Seriously. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in today and texted in. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. I will be back next week on Tuesday, and you will get Mary Margaret back on Thursday. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. And Sigur is ticking over now, but I am leaving you with Inglourious by Slow Time. Enjoy your week, and I'll see you in a couple of days. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.